Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is the first part of episode 34, where we are discussing Eric Trist and Ken Bamforth's 1951 paper, Some Social and Psychological Consequences of the Longwall Method of Coal Getting, published in the journal Human Relations. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is Tom calling from Carlisle in Pennsylvania, the United States.
And this is Pedro coming to you from the University of Warwick in the UK.
This is Miranda coming to you from Udine in Italy.
And this is Joe coming from Melbourne in Florida.
Good morning, everybody.
Hello.
So so we have here is a very interesting article. It was published in 1951 in Human Relations, and it covers coal mining and the social and psychological consequences of changing the method that was used to gather the coal. And it's a very technically oriented article, I would say. Probably in 1951, the readership would be much more familiar with coal mining than perhaps today's audiences are. And there are a lot of terms that just seem to be naturally understood by Trist and Bamforth that may not be clear now. So I wanted to start off the episode by talking a bit about the context of the article and also explaining what the situation was with respect to what did the technological change, what did it really mean in terms of the way that the workers did their job. And Pedro, I'd like you to go ahead and talk a little bit about the background of the article, the context in which it was written.
Glad to do so. So a bit of the general theoretical context in which this article was produced. So as you might know, it was done by two researchers associated to the Tavistock Institute based in London that is still is in operation. And the Tavistock had traditionally a research program which was somehow close to the one of the Hawthorne studies. That is, they have read the work of Mayo and Rosalys Berger, and they were interested in understanding the social relations in the workplace. They were influenced by both psychology and sociology and related disciplines, and there was this effort of seeing the work process and the work system not merely as a machine-like kind of system, but also a social technological, as they use the word, social technical system. They did a lot of research in the mining industry. I think it was the first one that was done. And what is interesting is that you can see in this paper a lot of the characteristics of the work of the Tavistock, which is, above all, an interest of not only the productivity of the workplace, but also the welfare of the workers. You know, there is this overall sense that, you know, trying to improve productivity, but also the way work took place. A bit about the general connections with previous episodes. First, I think it's interesting to say that this context that is being described, the Longwall method, is very resemblant of a Tayloristic organization. You know, so basically the author is describing how the arrival of mechanization in the mining kind of changed the way the work is organized. So there's a lot about Taylorism here. There's a lot of also the consequence of Taylorism, as we discussed in the last episode about Rothlis Berger. And I also want to flag one thing. There's a lot of the discussions here that are connected to the work of an important sociologist, Alvin Goldner, which was doing research in the mining industry as well, and the changes that were happening in the 50s. So,
and I think maybe one thing we want to do is just describe. I know the article covers this a little bit, but we want to describe the difference between the two methods, the handgot versus the longwall, and why that represented a technological change. The handgot method was small teams that were working together, essentially digging the coal by hand. And then the longwall method is where the coal face was expanded to significantly greater length. And so you had folks distributed along large coalface wall. And my readings on this suggested that some of these long walls in some mines, I don't know if it was the case for this one that we're talking about in this article, but some of these long wall faces could go kilometers long, like 2 to 3 kilometers long. And so you can kind of picture the difference between, say, in a short face, you know, roughly a room, you know, a wall in a room with several people digging by hand versus, say, people spread out along a 2 kilometer long wall digging the coal that way. So that's, I think there probably was assumed that folks reading the article understood the difference between what the handgod and the longwall method was. And it's also, I should also mention that some places did longwall before it was mechanized. So this particular article is focused on moving to the longwall in a mechanized fashion, which really was a significant change in the way things were done.
I think one of the things that that I found most fascinating of this entire piece, taking it in its generality, is that it belongs to the 1950s, and it belongs to an industry that that was very important at that time. And yes, it does have a very Tayloristic characteristic to it, but already in the title, we're talking about the social and psychological consequences of the method. So I think what is fascinating, to put it into a historical context, is that we have already a very strong awareness of the fact that changing things in the workplace could have important social and psychological consequences. And I think this is something that it's interesting to reflect upon, and that maybe is something we take for granted, given that organization studies has moved in this direction and talks about these topics. But actually, for that period of time, it was pretty important.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Sorry, just a quick thing. What I usually like about the classic text is exactly that you can see the emergence of the field, and you can see how they're making a case that what is experience. And, you know, I think they say that, you know, what doctors were reporting that were problems of the individuals is actually the consequence of a social level, a system level thing. You know, so this attention of, you know, linking what is happening to one person, to having causes that are social, is, you know, what is, well, that's what we do nowadays. But, you know, it started somewhere. Someone has to push it first.
I was struck by the seeming lack of understanding, and this is seeming, it was slightly addressed, but the lack of understanding by management of the social change impact on work output when they went from the handgot to the longwall method, and the delta between the actuality of performance compared to the potentiality of performance. When you look back, there were a lot of labor strife in the coal mines, and this now to me provides some insight, since I didn't have the insight on what caused that labor strife. This seems to now provide some insight into the sources of where that strife came from, and what could have potentially been done to reduce it or address it when it actually did happen. And then the other part is, which we'll talk about, is the modern corollary for me is the open office movement, and how it will likely lead to labor strife, however, with an ununionized, largely workforce.
Okay. Yeah, we're definitely going to get into that. But I want to get to add on to your first point, because I found it interesting that Tristan Bamforth made it very clear in some parts of the article that they didn't necessarily fault management in it wasn't that management was evil or was doing this intentionally. They were just, it was just new. It was just something that they would just had not thought about, which is kind of interesting, because now, you know, of course, that sort of thing, management is very much aware of what they should be looking for in terms of the social and psychological consequences of any organizational reengineering that they do. At the time, it was just that it was completely different, and management was appears to be caught unaware. And you're absolutely right that the social strife around the coal mining industry at that time was definitely growing, and so that's something that we would want to be trying to avoid in the future.
Can I just say one thing in response to that? I think in part the reason why management seems a bit unaware or vague about these issues is because, well, if you think in Taylor-Risick terms, you're prone to manage the individual. You're prone to manage the task at hand, but not necessarily the system. So I think that's the difference. There is no, you can see there is a, the authors are pushing to understand the organization as a system, not necessarily just like a one-to-one thing as could be traditionally thought as the role of management, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it does. And similarly in page 9 of the article, the authors started to talk about the intermediate layer and the emergence of the intermediate layer of organization. We think about the way that they were organized previously. It was essentially, two layers. It was, the management, and then it was the workers who were organized in small teams mining the coal face. There was basically nothing in between. And then when you have this the emergence of a new technology that requires that you have something to manage, to essentially build this and manage the system, and this middle layer starts to grow, there's a lot of questions about what exactly does this middle layer have to do? They have to translate the strategic direction into action and whatnot. But I sense that there was a lot of uncertainty is associated with how do you grow in order to be able to properly manage this much more complex, technologically advanced process.
I don't want to dominate the conversation too much, especially because Joey has to leave, but maybe it's something that we can discuss later, but I wonder how much is due to mechanization when he says it, as the author says. But for me, this smells more like bureaucratization. It's not only the technological change, but, there is intermingled also the way the social system changes as well. And in a way, although the authors are aware of that, but many times they write as if the only change that is happening is a mechanization, not necessarily a bureaucratization as well.
Because, yes, you kind of do see that starting to grow. And they discuss that in the article pretty much throughout the throughout the second half.
What I had written down here is that when there is the change from the what they call the room and pillar techniques to the long wall, there is, as you said, this larger scale thing, and there is the mechanization because you have machines that made possible to have this such large scale in the first place. But I think there is very traditional things associated to bureaucracy in which are regarding specialization. There is a clear hierarchy and expected that supervision is going to happen. There is a standard work for different people, even though it's not respected, but there is expectation it would. There is specific procedures that each sub-specialized role has to abide to. So this is proper, formalization of how things are supposed to happen. Even though the whole article, in a way, is trying to say that, it doesn't really is that productive and is not really that possible in this context. But, we'll get to that.
Well, it also it talks about how the pay scale and the way in which the members, the different members within each role were compensated, mm-hmm. and the level of differentiation is it's remarkable because it just seems like that by itself would have put some tremendous pressures on any sense of social cohesion. If you're talking about mm-hmm. Folks who are on one shift, mm-hmm. who are being paid based on how much coal that they break off of the face, versus other positions who were working a different shift, who were being paid, by comparison, an absolute pittance for the role of hauling it out. And then you know, and these folks on different shifts don't see each other.
I was absolutely fascinated by the discussion there of how the shifts were so isolated from each other, because that seems, standing today, looking at how we manage work, it's almost implicitly understood that if you don't have face-to-face turnover, then you very likely have these gaps mm-hmm. and these stresses introduced by that lack of turnover. In having managed an industrial organization, you may actually make the choice not to work particular jobs on sequential shifts simply because the turnovers are so ineffective that you get very little out of it, and you try to keep the work all on one shift. So that was absolutely interesting to see how they broadly across the sample that they saw, Tristan Bamforth saw, that the workers were segregated. Mm-hmm. But then you also look at it from the perspective of the mine owner or operator, by having the elevator go down with the work crew and then the off-going work crew switches places and comes up the elevator, you reduce the total time you have your workforce exposed to some mine disaster. That almost makes sense. It would have been very interesting to see if there had been a study done on what happens if you allow a interaction between the shifts.
I share your feeling, because I think that was something that struck me as well, which, I mean, nowadays we look at that and say, well, we know that there is all kinds of mechanisms that are in place to make sure there is social cohesion and mutual understanding, all that kind of stuff, you know. But I keep thinking that maybe what they have reported here is the, you know, first moment of the arrival of a new system, and there is this normal disadjustment at first, you know. And I can also imagine someone having this, you know, as they say, completely copying the way it was done in factories, and specifically, you know, in a Tayloristic situation, there is this idea that, you know, you can just split the work as you please in the most, you know, in principle, most efficient way in the subtasks. But, you know, it seems almost that there is no attention to the need for integration of all these different roles and tasks after. And there is not just like, you know, an input-output machine. You know, if people don't know each other, if they don't have respect to each other, things get very tricky.
Yeah, and the other thing that really struck me was the social fabric. I mean, when I think about the expression of the small team working at the coalface, it wasn't so much that the task was simpler or what have you. I mean, it was definitely hard work. But the fact that everybody who – all of those different functions that were differentiated in the longwall method, all being together, got not just the professional side of life working together, but it was carrying so much out into the social environment on the outside. The authors talked about that whenever there was a disaster in the family, the families would get together. There was all of that social cohesion outside of the work environments that was really valuable. And that was a big loss when they mechanized and went to this differentiated shift, because, you know, it wasn't just that there was no turnover. There was also no social connection once you were outside of the mine. The families weren't together. There was nothing to bring people together to keep the satisfaction or morale high. And this also kind of reminds me of now, I've never been in a coal mine, but I have visited a couple of salt mines. I mean, there's some similarities, but there's one salt mine out in Poland that's now a tourist haven. And if you want to talk about an example of a social fabric being visibly put on display, it's called the Wieliczka salt mine, and it's located not too far away from Krakow. And when you go down there, salt is a little bit more pliable than coal, so it was just about all hand got. But what was interesting was that the isolation of working deep underground, digging salt out, the miners found some very interesting ways to occupy themselves. And so what they did was, as they carved out a room basically a small sub cave or what have you, they converted it into a gallery, and they were doing etchings on the side of the wall. The initial ones weren't very sophisticated, but by the time that you get down to the very lower levels, after they'd been digging in the mine for decades, they had this one room that's basically an entire Roman Catholic cathedral, complete with wall etchings of biblical scenes all around. They simulated tile on the floor just by the way that they etched. Mm-hmm. And so, that was not just a way of keeping, of the miners occupying themselves. This was basically an expression of community, because they turned it into their own place of worship, place of community, or what have you. And then you go into some of the later ones when Marxism started to come in, and you started to see the etchings in the walls change from religion to Marxist expressions of solidarity, worker solidarity. Oh, wow. And so it was very interesting to see that. And so, in such a harsh environment, you can imagine the importance of the social fabric, like, for example, that famous incident down in, I think it was Peru or Chile, a few years ago, where you had those 33 trapped for hundreds of days. If you don't have a social fabric, then when disaster strikes, you worry about how are these people going to be resilient in the face of that type of an adversity where they're cut off from the outside.
Well, it also reminds me, I love this example, thank you for sharing, because it also reminds me of episode 13, in which we discussed the text by Donald Roy, I think, which is called Banana Time, in which we have a case of industrial workers, working in a normal factory, and the text is about the little games that the workers create in order to keep themselves occupied, and again, to create these relations in a work that is very individualized, so it shows again, in even a less extreme situation, the importance of social relations and nurturing them, and the ways that workers themselves have throughout time thought about, to create the necessary work conditions for them. So it's interesting to see this parallel.
And I suppose that I do similar things in the workplace now where I'm at in academia, because we're all so independent. So we have to find interesting ways to come together as a department. And I suspect that that's probably not all that uncommon.
Yeah, that's true. For instance, here at Warwick, I think that's most places, they have the traditional coffee time at 10 or 11, in which, from the secretaries to the senior professors in principle come together and have coffee. And there is this overall seeing each other, moment.
Oh, yeah. And you really have to work at that, because sometimes when you have professors who are off on travel constantly doing studies all over the world, it's really hard to get everybody together.
I think it's also especially important in places that, for their structural characteristics, are isolated. So if you go back to the situation of coal mines and you think about these coal mines that create a very isolating situation because you're in the dark, you're beneath earth, it's particularly important to know who's around you.
Oh, definitely. And it's not just who's around, but what's going on elsewhere in the mine, because when you are isolated and it's a dangerous location, the article did mention about the dangers of floors rising up because of gas, mm-hmm. The roof collapsing. And when you're in the dark, you don't really have the ability to see what's really going on around, and you can imagine the noise that is down there. You can't really decipher what's going on in the environment around you, and that is just amazing to me how you can keep your head in that kind of a situation, especially if you're kind of new to it.
Can I just make a link, since we are thinking about, connections? When the authors describe the case of the Feelers, which they characterize as one of dependent isolation, because they are a shift by themselves, and they work in complete, in an individual manner. So there is no subgroup or pair, you know, it's like just these people doing their work. And in a way, they suffer the consequence of the previous work of all the other roles to them. So they're completely by themselves, and they are vulnerable to the quality of the works of the other specialists. So the way they are characterizing the struggles that these people have in this feeling of isolation and being unable to control anything about their work made me think of a recent piece in the Financial Times about the gig economy and the bad consequences of the gig economy, which in a way it's due exactly to that, to creating circumstances in which people work by themselves and are managed by impersonal control mechanisms like an algorithm, and suffer from that a number of, psychological, even health-related malaises, you know. So they're talking about Uber drivers and Deliveroo people that, for instance, there was this case of this Uber driver that before, and when he was a taxi driver, he would meet other taxi drivers, you know, when work was low and so on and so forth. But now he found himself just driving all the time, following the directions of the algorithm, and really felt in his mood and in his overall mental health, I would say, a change, a negative change. So it's interesting that even in the most modern way of organizing work, these things still endure.
Yeah, that I can definitely see that as well, because in a lot of places where I've traveled, you know, it used to be that you had, taxi drivers and a sort of a community of taxi drivers at certain locations who they would just get together and chat. And then when there was a surge of people looking for taxis, they would just they'd go on to their business. But that's very interesting that Uber drivers, because of that isolation, you know, that that separation from everybody else is not feeling that, and the algorithmic aspect of it is interesting too, because I almost feel like that every time I get a robocall from some, you know, poor soul who's sitting in a booth somewhere in an unknown location is on the other end of the phone trying to do the job of engaging with people.
So, and there's another aspect that's actually reflected in Tristan Bamford to some extent, and that's the competition, because having driven in a few taxis ridden in a few taxis in Australia, there's an extension where they can know who else they're competing against now in a very real way. So they can figure out by the amount of time they are away from a potential call whether they will get there to get the fare or not. And that introduces another level of stress. It was very interesting. I actually spoke to one of the taxi drivers about it. And it's partly good, but it also dramatically increases his stress, because now he's trying to figure out, can he cut a corner, run a light in order to get to that fare? And it's pretty interesting to see the consequences of that approach.
It's, you know, that's almost a case where too much information is not good.
At least in one driver's case, he liked it better when the dispatcher just told him where to go. Here was, I guess, where I got to the open office and why I started looking at it after having read and studied Tristan Bamforth. So, I pulled not only this paper by Tristan Bamforth, but a number of others, and looked at them. And they followed this steady pattern, if you will, of we have an industry where we make significant changes and there are unintended consequences which are slow to be understood. And when you look at them, they rob the new system of its full potentiality. And I'm using actuality, capability, and potentiality in Stafford Beer's terms, where actuality is what the system performs, capability is what it could do with the current resources, and potentiality is if you invested in it, you would get some higher level of performance. And in this case, that investment has been made. In the coal mining case, we went from the hand-got method to the long-wall method, and they pretty clearly make the case that there's a gap between what's actually done and what could be done in terms of production if some of the social factors were considered. And I had been kind of looking at the open office, and I've sent a link which we can post to at least one article, and I can add a couple others, and the articles are available. To me, the open office movement seems to be another one of these examples where we make a large-scale change to the way things have been done, and in this case, office structure, office design, and they're with what I would call the best of intentions, but the reality comes out to be less than expected. And so I pulled a series of papers where the research appears to be fairly consistent that if you're really doing thought work, work that requires some focused attention, and you need to really, really zoom in on what you're doing for an extended period of time, the open office design does not help in that case for a large fraction of the workers. And the research goes back into the 70s, and there's also relatively recent research that's been published on this. And so I find it interesting that that wave of thought, if you will, has managed to continue despite both the research and the unhappiness of the workers who have seen the change. And so I wonder, you know, what's the parallel to the coal miners, and how do we, because I consider myself part of management often, how do we manage to fall into this trap where we fall for a seductive idea, the reality of which doesn't match when we actually go do it?
That is very interesting, but what maybe I'm a cynic, but what I think is in the case of the open office is because what really is wanted is not necessarily the productivity or whatever, it's the ability to monitor.
And so that fascinates me. I guess I would have to pull that literature to look at it, because it would seem to me then that the data from the open office system would then show that we've actually lost productivity. And while we can now know that we have lost it, I would think that with the IT systems available, you could know that whether the person is sitting in a single office, a bullpen, or a large open office design, simply by what they actually produce, and that our ability to measure that would be similar across all of those aspects.
I may not be as familiar with the literature, but let me kind of ask: wasn't the open office idea supposed to eliminate also another form of social malaise, which is the static and unfeeling sense of being in a cubicle? You know, wasn't it supposed to try to offer a sense of flexibility, a sense of freedom? Well, I mean, it wound up basically replacing one form of social malaise with another.
And I think also there was this expectation, and there is now the expectation, that in a way it makes organizations more collaborative because people from different departments are close to each other. They are more easily to bump into each other and have productive conversations. So there is also this aspect of, you know, trying to engineer relations in a way.
Yeah, and so when I think about why there may be an inability to respond to these studies that are showing that it doesn't work, okay, so then if you undo it, you go back to the old social malaise, and there's probably a bit of distaste for doing that. Like, if you undo it, we go back to the old way of doing it, which we hated. So if we're going to wind up being unhappy anyway, might as well stay the way we are.
Yeah. So I guess we are touching on the problem of change in general, you know, which deals with technology change, like proper implementing a new ERP or just, you know, putting people in an open office, and how we are doing that for the best of the reasons. But many times it's kind of, you know, it can go in so many different directions.
Oh, absolutely.
Because we talked about the concept of change, I wanted to add that I think there's one one element that is touched upon in different parts of the text, which is quite fascinating. And it's this idea that the workers have some sort of resistance to change, which is very negative and very strong. So there's a lot of mention of words like bad attitudes, even suspicions of the workers towards management, because they're used to doing things in a certain way and they don't see why they should change it. And I think this is quite, it's interesting how it pops up in different parts. I'm not sure if anyone picked that up.
No, I didn't. So I'd be glad if you shared more a bit about that.
Yeah. So there's, I can't remember precisely in which parts, but they talk about workers.
I think.
Yeah, please.
I was going to say that there was a bit of it in pages 31 and 32 on reactive individualism. That's where I saw quite a bit of that. You know, and because it wasn't just dissatisfaction. There was also a sense of individual competition, which was not necessarily healthy, such as that. You know, naturally, in a coal face, you could be just out of sheer coincidence. You could be advantaged or disadvantaged. If you were in the middle of the coal face and you were one of the ones hauling the coal away, you wanted to be as close to the gate as you could, or as close to the exit. So there was competition, unhealthy competition going on there. Mm-hmm. And then there was, even in advance, as the mind expanded, I'm looking for the passage, was that that there would be some negotiation or, activities going on where folks would try to fight to get what they thought was the ideal spot, because the coal was softer, easier to pull out, and they would get more credit for the coal that they would pull out. You didn't want to be stuck at a bad seam. And so there was a lot of that in pages 31 and 32 about what was going on there. And then, the resistance part is also embedded.
I also had in mind a concepts that kind of build into this idea of the worker that has an ownership over his task and is kind of like the owner of a certain level of expertise of how it should be best done, instead of like taking for granted that management knows how it should be best done. And I find it quite different from the Tayloristic approach in that sense. Even though we're talking about coal mining, so not necessarily a job that can be recognized as a job that has a certain level of specialization in terms of technicalities and expertise.
So I thought that part of the resistance was in the section on absences, where the various groups actually would get together outside of the mine, and if there were too many absences, they would all go home. So basically you'd lose a whole shift then, and actually you'd probably lose a whole day, because the next two shifts wouldn't be able to accomplish their work if the missing shift didn't do theirs. I think there was a discussion there on fillers, where they basically came to that conclusion that if there were too many fillers missing, then the whole team went home and nobody worked that day, just because life was going to be too hard, which I think is a form of resistance.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's along in the same section of the absenteeism problem in around page 33. There was you get a filler returning from his week's holiday with pay, complained that the first two shifts had knocked it all out of him, which is what I interpret as meaning. Basically, he didn't have enough to do and was not going to be able to get his anticipated workload, and therefore not get his anticipated level of pay.
Right. So if we can return for a sec to the open office discussion, where workers decide whether they're going to cooperate or not. In one of the papers, which I'll provide later, by Oldham and Brass, they talk about how many of the decisions in open offices are actually made based on prejudices and beliefs rather than knowledge. And so I find that interesting. you know, because that's a pretty damning statement. But then the other part is the anecdote that there are Apple engineers who have refused to move out of their present building to go to that new building because it's an open office, and they have no desire to go to that environment. So to me, that's a similar kind of absence thing. Apparently, they were trying to hide and not even be visible until somebody outed them in, you know, on the internet. You know, you have that level of resistance to change, and I guess my experience has been that resistance to change is almost always because people think that their future will be worse than their present. Whether it's true or not is a different matter, but that's almost always why I've seen resistance.
I was just going to say, I agree with this general statement, but I think that something specific about the open office, or about these kind of changes, you know, as we know, many times people can resist changes because they were not consulted in the first place. So they can interpret that as something that is forced upon them. And the specific case of the open office, you know, Apple engineers are people that have a lot of prestige. And if you think, they are almost probably see themselves almost like they have this, what in the 50s people would say, the craft sense of pride, you know, as they feel that they have autonomy to decide how they're going to do the work that they want to do. So it's a way of reasserting maybe this feeling of autonomy, you know, not willing to be working for own people and feeling that someone is going to be looking over their shoulder for what they're doing, so on and so forth. So I think that's something more about being able to impose your own tools and ways of working in this case. I mentioned before that in the 50s, Alvin Goldner was also doing research in mines. And what's very interesting in his work is that it's he wants to understand how in a mine, both in the face of the mine, but also in the part that was more factory-like outside in which they were processing the gypsum, there was a push from the headquarters to make the whole work process more bureaucratic. So to formalize, to be more standardized, to have more specialization in the different roles and so on and so forth. And he describes how the change was very effective in the more factory-like areas of the mine, but in the face, in the ones that really people are there inside under underground, it was not. And he says that it has to do with the way of the very nature of the work context in which, for him, the mine is so hard to standardize the work. It's so hard to predict all that can go wrong in a way. And it's such a difficult environment that, you know, in a way, the attempts to bureaucratize were held back.
So I think what I just heard is, if you're familiar with the Kinevan framework, right, the, you know, the quadrants of obvious, complicated, complex, and chaos, you know, the management belief that one size fits all often ignores the actual domain in which the problem is in. So when it is either obvious or complicated, I think that bureaucratization works. When you get over into that complex domain, bureaucratization breaks down simply because you can't have a rule for every condition, right? And that's what you just described. You know, and actually Tristan Bamford discussed that as far as, you know, the rising floor, the rise, you know, the roll up, the roll down. So, and the workers in the condition when it is complex have usually developed a set of heuristics that enable them to handle the complexities. But those heuristics are very difficult to translate into hard and fast rules because there's so many conditions associated with the heuristic.
I disagree just in terms because I think, you know, just because I study bureaucracy and I'm so hooked into, you know, understand its different manifestations, I don't think it's necessarily bureaucracy yes or no. It's more what kind of formalization can be done. Maybe you cannot formalize all the way the different steps for the task, but you can formalize in a way that, I don't know, you're going to have to be accountable for someone in specific, and you have a set of best practice to deal with problematic scenarios, you know. So I think it's more about the kind of bureaucracy, not necessarily the presence or absence. Having said that, I think what is interesting to think is that, I mean, why this new method was, you know, so problematic, as in the way it was presented in the mind, because if you think, it is a very canonic application of Taylorism or traditional bureaucracy, and what probably, knowing the things that we know today, could be done otherwise?
Well, that's a very good question, and one of the first things that that comes to my mind is putting myself in the position of the manager. We've been talking mostly at this point of talking from the perspective of the workers and the immediate supervisors, but if you are the manager, there are some significant pressures for you to impose change or to come up with change or, you know, what have you, that that aren't always going to allow you to think through the social and psychological implications of what you're about to do, because your stakeholders are putting demands upon you to say that you've got to fix something. We may not know what to fix, but you have to go fix something. And if that is, you know, we need to produce more coal, we need to, you know, do engineer, be more innovative, you know, is what have you. And so, unfortunately, you know, as much as we certainly don't want to see top-down driven strategies that don't listen to what the workforce wants, sometimes, unfortunately, managers are left with that, or, you know, they're left with that position, left with having to do something and, you know, damn the consequences, full speed ahead. And so then it's a matter of how do you arm the managers with the ability to think through in a rather efficient way all of the implications of their decisions before they're forced to make it. Mm-hmm. And that's hard. And that concludes part one of episode 34. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or through our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Don't forget that we now have a newsletter that comes out the day after each episode and contains some bonus and unique content. You can subscribe to that using your email only on our website. Please join us next time as we discuss part two of Tristan Bamforth's 1951 paper, Some Social and Psychological Consequences of the Longwall Method of Coal Getting, here on Talking About Organizations.